Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. We're going to take a deep dive on defense today with the defensive coordinator and safeties coach at the University of Findlay, Jason Macrinos. Jason, it's great to be here talking ball with you today.
Thanks for having me on, Keith. Big fan of the show. We're heavy into recruiting right now, and this is kind of where I've learned about the show. I've spent many hours on the road in between schools and homes listening to your show here, so excited about this opportunity to be on today.
Well, I appreciate that. That's great to hear. Well, Coach, we're going to get into some of the details of what you guys do on defense and some of the things you believe in. Before that, I just want you to share with our listeners a little bit on your background and where you've been in the path to where you are right now at the University of Findlay.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and, you know, that's a football town. And so that was in my blood early. I just remember I would talk football, and I still do with my mom, because my mom was the bigger football fan than my dad. And, you know, just grew up loving the Steelers and grew up on Bill Cowher and Dick LeBeau. And, you know, I knew at an early age that I wasn't going to be able to play in the National Football League or anything like that. So, you know, those guys, I had to, you know, grow an affinity for them. And, you know, those guys just led me down the road of thinking about becoming a coach. And went to Westminster College, played for Jerry Schmidt, who was the head football coach at Duquesne University there, an FCS school in Pittsburgh, and was a psychology major because I had done my homework and knew that there were some really good coaches, guys like Jimmy Johnson and Urban Meyer that were, you know, had a psychology background, and that would be beneficial for coaching. You know, once I graduated from there, I was able to get my first graduate assistant job with Dr. George Mihalik, who should be, you know, a college football Hall of Famer one day, but was a great and still is great, great mentor. And, you know, had an opportunity after Slippery Rock as a GA to go to Kent State as a graduate assistant. I was there for a year when Julian Edelman was our quarterback. And I guess I didn't realize it at the time, but Sean McVay was a receiver when we played Miami. I saw that video come out last year when those guys were playing the Super Bowl. From there, had some experience at Carnegie Mellon University with another great, great football coach in Rich Lackner, who's been coaching for about 35 years now at the same school. Another just great person, saw another way of doing things. And there were odd similarities between Coach Lackner and Coach Mihalik. And those guys are, you know, have made a dent in my beliefs in coaching and all that. So then an opportunity to go back to Slippery Rock as a full-time coach and spent 4 years there with, you know, Sean Lutz was our defensive coordinator there at Slippery Rock, who's now the head coach. You know, from there, had an opportunity to go to Duquesne and coach for a year under my college head coach. And then Rob Keyes, who I had met when I was at Slippery Rock, had an opportunity for me to become a defensive coordinator. And so 5 years ago, came out to Northwest Ohio here in Findlay, and I had my first opportunity to be a defensive coordinator. And, you know, just the amount of knowledge that you learn year to year doing this compared to just coaching a position is unbelievable. So that's how I kind of got to the point where I am right now.
And Coach, talk to us a little bit about the defense you play. I know, you know, before we got going, you share with me it's a 4-2-5. You say very similar to things that Penn State and Mississippi State do.
Yeah, so when we first got to Findlay 5 years ago, we were 4-3, a lot of quarters. And, you know, it was a good system. It allowed us to get better on defense. It was simple, but there were some, you know, just some limitations. There were just some issues that I constantly had with it from, you know, guys in conflict and angles. And so we really started to explore, you know, really transitioning to playing a 4-2-5, keeping, you know, your inside linebackers in A's and B gaps, playing more of a 7 technique. You know, at times taking that overhang, which we call a spur, some people call a star, you know, truly taking him out of the run fit altogether. I mean, looking to gain your run support from, you know, different places. And the last really, you know, we've run different forms of quarter, quarter, half. We have two different things, but, you know, it's some form or fashion of quarters to the field and some form or fashion of cover two into the boundary, the call side, the away side, as we'll say. What I like about that is it gives you very good angles in the run game from the standpoint of you have an outside in angle in setting edges, and your numbers allow you to be good in the run. Your numbers allow you to dictate, you know, where you gain your run support and where you want to, you know, have the offense attempt to attack you from an RPO standpoint. It's very, very dynamic. I feel for our guys now, we actually do a lot more than we were than when we were just a 4-3 quarters team, do a lot more. But for us, it's really just tiny tweaks. It's the same, a lot of times the same run fits. We're just changing how we play the triangle to the field and how we play the triangle to the boundary. I mean, it's quarters, but you think about all the different ways that you can play quarters, whether you want to play more of a palms concept and read number two, whether you want to, you know, buzz your overhang right to number one right now, you know, just some different things that we do there. How do you want to play your cover two into the boundary? Do you want to play a true cloud support with a true half field safety, or do you want to play more of a trap corner technique, or do you want to invert your corner? You know, all those different things are manipulating the quarterback and what he sees. And for us, not much changes, but I think in the offensive world these days where they're trying to read, you know, second and third level defenders, it can be challenging for them at times. And in, you know, with how we have the ability to play it, we, from a defensive standpoint, can then determine, you know, RPO wise, what do we want? Do we want them to RPO us to the field, to the boundary? Do we want them to hand the football off? Do we want them to throw it? That gives us an advantage from that standpoint.
Going back to the days of how you defended the option, right? And the first thing was, well, who is it we want to carry the ball on this particular team? And there were sometimes you wanted to see that pitch because their quarterback was the most dynamic guy, and other times you wanted to make sure you took that away, or, you know, whatever it might be in that triple option scenario. So, Coach, as you mentioned, you know, the variations there that you give a quarterback, and that's, you know, especially as we look at this at the high school level, the more stuff you can throw in front of that guy, the more confused he is, and that ball is coming out a little bit later and things start breaking down. So, you know, the defense ends up winning in that situation. When you look at all the variations you have to do that, and I know some of it you said is we decide who we want to have the football, but how many do you typically carry into a game? Is it something that you're prepared with all of them? And I guess as a follow-up that we could get to, I'll ask again if you need to, but, you know, practicing that and making sure that everything's getting the repetition you need from week to week. How are you looking at that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a great question. And that's something that I think I've gotten a lot better at recently, you know, how I develop a game plan. Obviously in camp and in spring, we are throwing everything in the kitchen sink at them. You know, we're going to install stuff in camp. We're going to install stuff in the spring that, you know, we might not use it until week eight, but week eight, we know we play that team every year and we know what they do and we got to win that game. And that's why we're carrying it. So we're going to install everything there. And then the thing that I've done a better job at, in my opinion, is I first look at what do we do well? Yes, I know this concept or is good versus this, and this concept is good versus that, but we're just not that good at doing that. And is it, you know, why is that? You know, are we not teaching it good enough? Are we not drilling it enough? You know, those are the different conversations that we'll have. But from a week-to-week game planning standpoint, I first look at what are we doing a good job at playing? So it starts there. If I'm not comfortable with it, if the players aren't comfortable with it, it's not in the game plan. But we'll have, to answer your question, at least two ways of defending everything in the game plan, you know, knowing that we have the ability to fall back upon something that maybe we did in camp, because there's fundamental principles as far as reading your keys that's all encompassing. And just something as simple, we've done it on the sideline. We teach concepts, you know, hey, we're playing cover two. Hey, we're going to play cover two this week as a vertical hook compared to a hook. Well, now, you know, if number two runs vertical, you know, we may carry him this week, or from series to series, it may change. Hey, we're going to carry two if he goes vertical, or we may just wall him if he goes vertical. We've had the ability with how we teach things to change within the game from series to series. So, yeah, about two different ways, base that we'll be able to play everything with the ability to go 3-4 different ways if there's something that's really giving us an issue.
Coach, as you start to look at those things, how much of that becomes the matchup side of the game where you're looking at, you know, your personnel versus their personnel? You already mentioned, like, you know, who do we want to have the ball? Sometimes while that's all good in theory, then there has to be a guy who's defending, you know, what you're taking away. So how do you look at those matchups to create that situation, I guess, that you're dictating?
Right. No question. I mean, that's the other thing you're always looking at too, is who can beat us? You know, who can't we defend? You know, who is a scheme changer? That's a lot of times where the third option comes in. You know, let's just say we're looking at different ways of playing our cover two into the boundary. We might have one where we play a trap corner. We might have one where we invert it and roll the safety down and in theory be the flat player and have a, you know, the inverted half corner. But maybe you have a guy over there that's just a problem and we're struggling to defend him. We may pinch all the gaps and play a true cloud corner over there at times on first and second down. You know, that's going to be a change up because I still truly believe at first and second down, we ultimately have to stop the run. And then third down, you know, we're going to look at, you know, you differently. Now, is there a guy that you are targeting on third down? Like there is that guy, our third down game plan is a lot of times going to be centered around on stopping that person and also getting a lot of pressure on the quarterback.
Coach, in looking at the way you guys have been able to take the ball away from people, and that's been something you guys have been really good at the last 3 years on a, you know, on the national level, really high in the rankings and takeaways. As you talk about some of those things, how much of that does play into you being able to set up the defense to get those opportunities to take the football away?
Oh, I mean, that's big time. And about 3 years ago, I guess I've been at Finley for 5 years, and we saw a lot of improvement in year one to year two in a lot of the different areas, stopping the run, getting off the field on third downs. But again, every March or February, March, we do our research and development. We didn't improve in takeaways. We had like 13 the first year. We had 13 the second year. And Coach Keys, our head football coach, made it a point amongst our whole team. I mean, this is just one of the things. I can get into a lot of things, but we instilled a ball period, both for the offensive side of the football and the defensive side of the football. But every day of practice, right after we flex, you know, we'll have a walkthrough, we flex. Right after we have 5 minutes of ball period, the offense works on ball security, and the defense, we work on different takeaways. And that was just part of it. You get what you emphasized. We did some things that, number one, starting from a recruiting standpoint, I've always looked at, you know, when I'm looking at safeties, I want to see guys that obviously can run and can hit. But then the guys that are jumping up my board or the guys that I can watch them play on offense and go take the football when they're playing receiver, looking at linebackers and seeing linebackers that are playing running back, I want to see guys that are athletes and guys that have ball skills, because one thing I have found is for defensive coaches, it's challenging to teach ball skills. Guys that have played baseball that understand how to track, those guys have been very good for us, you know, in the secondary and just reading the quarterback and the angle of his shoulder and the trajectory that the football is coming out at. But those guys with offensive backgrounds starts right there and just making sure, yes, you want guys that can run and can hit. But if you have ball skills and you're an athlete and you can play on both sides of the football and you're a multi-sport guy, those guys are going to the top of the recruiting board. Then from there, everything that we do from spoken affirmations is something that just kind of like my psychology background. And, you know, you listen to sports psychologists and positive self-talk in different ways to manipulate your own mind. I kind of just wanted to, first of all, have the mindset of we need to take the football from the offense. It's not turnovers, it's takeaways. So spoken affirmations, what I mean by that is every time we break a defensive meeting, every time we break a defensive huddle, I will say 3 times on 3, and they will go, the ball is ours, the ball is ours, the ball is ours. And that's what we break down every meeting on. It's just reminding them that football is yours. It's not the offense. That's their football. It's our football. It's our job to take it from them. So every year when you introduce your defensive goals, you know, a lot of defensive coordinators have stop the run as the number one goal. And yes, we are going to do everything in our power to dominate the run game and hold that ball carry to under 3 yards per carry. But besides points, the number one statistic that determines the success of your football team is the turnover margin. So I put take the football from the offense as our number one goal. And we want to have 3+ takeaways every time we step on the football field. Then we talk about from a philosophical standpoint of dominating the run game and then attacking the quarterback. And everything that we do revolves around those three things. So it's, yeah, don't just talk about it. You have to emphasize that. That's the number one thing that we have to do. We have to take the football from the offense. Yes, there may be times where, you know, we're not as statistically good in the red zone this year, statistically good on third downs. But if we are generating takeaways and giving our offense the football, those guys are good coaches. We have good players on that side of football. They're going to put the ball in the end zone. We're going to score. We're going to win games. And if you look at the difference in turnover margin the last 3 years, it's also been, you know, the most successful 3 years that the University of Findlay has had in the Division II era. So, you know, you have the spoken affirmations is the one thing that I talked about. Then we go back to signage. We don't have a lot of signs in our defensive rooms. There are two signs, posters, billboards, whatever you want to call them, that are in every one of our defensive meeting rooms. And one of them is a "The Ball Is Ours" poster. I have a picture of someone from the defensive line, linebacker group, whatever position group it may be, taking the football, and that hangs in the room. And so every time they walk into the room, you know, every time they start to, you know, drift off in the meetings and they look at the wall, I want them seeing "The Ball Is Ours" and just reminding them what we have to do. In addition to that signage, I've rewarded guys in the past that every time they get a takeaway, I get a picture of that takeaway. I send it to our SID and they, you know, they doctor it up with some cool Findlay logos and some Nike logos. And I give that poster to the player. Now that player hangs that poster a lot of times in their dorm room, their apartment, whatever it may be. At night, they're still seeing "The Ball Is Ours." And I'm constantly reminding these guys of what our number one job is. And it just becomes a mindset from that standpoint. So the spoken affirmations and the signage are my kind of ways of trying to manipulate those guys to have that mindset. Coach Keys, a couple summers ago, went down to OTAs with the Dallas Cowboys, and he saw, which right after I heard about this, I saw it on Football Scoop and whatnot, but basically it's the ball on the wall. I think Wilson developed it, but it's a football on springs and you attach it to a wall. We went and got two of those, and I have like three rules for the defense. And one of the rules is you must punch in and punch out of every defensive meeting. So again, we are, in theory, practicing one of our takeaway tools that we give them, whether it's a hammer, a rip, a punch. They're practicing one of those. And it's also a twofold thing, a mindset of, hey, man, we're in these meetings. You got to clock in and clock out, because what we do in here is just as important as everything else. So that, in addition to the ball period, are some of the different things that we have done to really spark that. And like I said, the last 3 years, we've been ranked in the top 25 in takeaways. We went from 13 to 31, and then we've stayed very consistent with it. And there's just so many things that once you do it from a mindset standpoint, then there's the physical aspect of it. How are you teaching forcing fumbles, recovering fumbles? How are you teaching interceptions and all those things? And we do a lot of different drills for all those things as well.
Yeah, I love it. And there's a lot to unpack there with some of the things you just covered here. And I'll start with the last one, the ball on the wall. And I remember this was right before the 2019 season. I was going through and had done basically a training camp series where I brought on a bunch of FBS guys to talk about, you know, the things they're doing in camp to build their units, their position, whatever it might be. And one of the coaches, I mean, he was a defensive coordinator, asked me about the ball on the wall had I've ever seen it. I'm like, I'm sorry, coach. I'm not quite sure what you're talking about. So now I know exactly where that came from. I appreciate that. I love that idea. I mean, you know, the three things, you know, that you do there, you know, the one being the spoken affirmations and saying that again and again. Actually starting it with that's your number one goal, then the spoken affirmations. I like that idea of the signage, and sometimes you can overdo the signage, but I think you have something that you're showing there that is that specific example. And, you know, I like that you have it for each position meeting room. And then what you do afterwards, I think, is an incredible thing of, you know, just reinforcing that what a great for you. It's easy. It's cheap for the kid, though. I'm sure there's just a ton of pride in getting that picture where he did exactly what our number one goal was. He took that football away, and it does have a lot of power. I could think of that on the reverse side when I coached at BW. Coach Meyer absolutely hated being beat on nakeds, you know, when his defensive ends would suck inside and that quarterback's on the edge. And so the young guys, he loved it. Like the young guys, I loved it when, you know, in the scout team, when we get them, and I would do the exact same thing with practice. I'd take a picture of that guy getting beat and chasing, you know, what he thought was the ball. And I would just draw an arrow, and it would say you, and then draw an arrow and say ball. And then under that, Coach Meyer called it the Jedi mind trick. So I found this is a funny meme of a stormtrooper just sitting at like a kitchen table with his hands on his head. And the caption was, "Those were the droids I was looking for." And, you know, so that was always something. He loved it, though, because we get on those kids' lockers and we would beat them when they were freshmen. And we might get them a couple times when they were sophomores. But I could never get, and we were good at naked. We could not get the first team on those kinds of things because he'd get them to be disciplined. That was what the visual that I gave him, but, you know, he loved it because we were teaching his kids something and having fun with it. But I do love that idea of the visuals that you're creating. That's an awesome idea. And then the other thing you talked about there, I thought was really interesting, was the ball skills. Looking for, you know, that guy who was that receiver who you saw running down the field and being able to track down that long ball, or, you know, the kid who plays center field or a shortstop that has to move to a ball coming at him from all kinds of different angles and has visual acuity to be able to get to that spot he's supposed to be to make the play, because those are the things that transfer over. You know, you see it in basketball too with some of the guys there, and I'm sure, you know, this time of the year in recruiting, you get to go out and see some of those guys as you're visiting, those guys who play basketball. And, you know, for you, I'm sure you're thinking right away, like, this is a guy who could play for us or not, based on what I've seen in this game and his ability to get to the basketball. And, you know, I love that. I love that idea that you have that aspect of it, that you are looking for that multi-sport guy. So awesome stuff there on how you guys create takeaways. The question I had as a follow-up there was, you know, you mentioned the everyday ball period. You know, there's a lot of things. I think we fall into some traps as coaches and think that if we go out and maybe replicate what another team's doing, that we're going to have that same success. And most of the times when it doesn't happen, it's because they failed to get some of those details that go along with it. So for me, that ball period is tremendous. But I'm interested in those fine forensic details that you teach in those different ball periods, within those drills, the skills you want to see, I guess, that start with punching in and out of that clock and some of those moves there, but the coaching points that are reinforced every day. And I think the thing that's great about some of those circuits is, you know, as you repeat them, you go from having two eyes on a drill to however many guys you have out there able to coach each other up and see it as well. And, you know, it's some great learning opportunities.
Yes, absolutely. The one, we have three different stations. We have our linebackers coach, we'll have a station, our D-line coach, and then myself will have a station, and we'll rotate daily. So they're working on these skills in theory once a week for 5 minutes a week. And we will switch up some of the ways that we do these drills so it's not, doesn't get stale and it doesn't get stagnant. We try as coaches to not just give them one way of doing things, because football is such a dynamic game. There's so many different angles that you play at and that the body works at, is we just try to give guys a toolbox and then educate them on when, you know, is a good time to use each tool. So just simply something is, you know, forcing the fumble. That goes back to, it starts with pursuit. We'll do pursuit drill. All right. And I think pursuit drill is a twofold thing. We'll have pursuit drills that are designed to teach just straight effort. Because if we aren't running to the football, we're not generating takeaways. All right. Period. The end. We're not going to get fumbles. We're not going to fumble them, or we're not going to recover them. So we have two different styles of pursuit drills, one for pure effort, and then one that will teach angles. Proper angles are important to being able to put your shoulder pad on a man. And, you know, which everyone is teaching, we're no different. Shoulder tackling, rugby style tackling, in my opinion, is shoulder tackling. But your ability to put your shoulder pad on a man as violent as possible is going to be predicated on having the proper angle. Okay. So now, once I've put my shoulder pad on that man and I've hit him in the strike zone, and we talk about the strike zone being between the numbers and the knees, and it's a very fluid game. You don't know what that ball carrier is going to do. You can't tell him one exact spot, but that's our strike zone between the numbers and the knees. Once you have put your shoulder pad on him and you've shot your shoulder, all right, we then talk about ripping our arms. That ripping movement generates the hips, and it's your standard kind of profile tackle. Now, once I've shot my shoulder and I've ripped my arms, okay, as I have the tackle secured, as we are falling to the ground, if the ball is to me, then as we're falling to the ground, we're going to talk about raking the ball out, because your body is naturally moving in the direction where a rake works. You're not going against the grain of the biomechanics of your body. And that rake, we're trying to get our hands on the fingertips of the ball carrier and ripping it away from his body. But the flip side of that, as I shoot my shoulder and I rip and I grip and the ball is away, that is when we have emphasized to them that rip, you want to punch. That's an opportunity to punch the ball to generate it coming out as well. Shoulder pad contact is the first most important thing. That's going to create the initial jolt that is going to allow the ball carrier to potentially loosen up his grip on the football. If the ball is away from me, we're emphasizing punching it, because your body is naturally working that way. You're not going against any of your momentum. So those are two specific ways that we force a fumble as we are making the tackle. Another way that we generate forcing these fumbles is we talk about being the second man in. So once the tackle has been secured, there's a pow, whatever it may be, we'll talk about throwing our uppercuts. And it's a ball, it will roll, is what we tell them. We try to throw uppercuts and pierce our fingertips in between the football and the rib cage and spin the ball out. Again, it's a ball, it will roll. We have generated some fumbles that way. The other way that the second man in, if that ball is to him, he will look to punch the elbow and try to pin the elbow to the ball carrier and then rake the ball out. So all four of those tools we give to our guys, and we try to teach to them when you should use these. And every team meeting I have involves showing them film of the fundamentals. Here is the drill. Here is the game footage of that drill. Now put to use and look at the result. So that fumble station is one part of it. The second part of our ball period, that circuit, will be matching the hand. And we have everyone from corners, because we blitz those guys, the D linemen, working on matching the hand. I mean, we always talk about, if you're not going to be able to get to the quarterback and get the sack before his front hand comes off the ball, then we talk about coming to balance. And then with our near hand, sticking it straight up in the air and extending our fingers out as wide as possible so we can generate the biggest surface area possible. One of the biggest mistakes I see with guys is they kind of shoot it out. We try to talk about getting it up to generate a more challenging throw for the quarterback. We've had many many, not just takeaways, but incomplete passes occur because of us matching the hand with our defensive linemen. They work on a different angle than the corner will. You know, a lot of times our corners, if they are blitzing, it's going to be off the edge. And we're never going to have a corner blitzing, you know, right up the A gap. So those guys will all work on different angles. We may have it where the D linemen have to defeat a cut block, then match the hand. We're linebackers, we may have them, you know, hit a move on a pop-up and then match the hand. Corners, they may just work on running a ring and then matching the hand. That is one skill that has been great for us in generating interceptions, deflected balls, which have led to defensive linemen intercepting passes, and then just incomplete passes in general. Then the third part of our circuit is the fumble recovery. And I'm not one, I do not take for granted recovering fumbles. I've seen too many clips of guys attempting to recover a fumble, and the next thing you know, it turns into a comedy show. That is one thing, again, in my every post-game Sunday afternoon meeting we have, I show all the takeaways. And I show the guy, I highlight the guy forcing the fumble, I highlight the guy recovering the fumble, because there's a right way to do it, in my opinion. And so we talk about city ball, country ball, and use that metaphor. If you're in traffic, you're in the city, you need to baseball slide to the side and pull the ball into you and recover it and get into that fetal position. If the ball is out there and you're in the country and there's no one around, that's your opportunity for a scoop and score. And we talk about getting square to the football, dropping your butt. Once you get over top of the football, bringing your pinkies together as you swoop underneath the ball and bring it up to you. And I tell those guys every time, I don't take for granted fumble recoveries. We got this one clean, and I've seen plenty of film of guys looking silly trying to recover a fumble. And knock on wood, we were about 100% on recovering fumbles. I can't remember or recall a time this year where we attempted to recover a fumble and did not get it. And so that's very valuable right there, and just not missing those opportunities. And how we drill that is we'll roll a ball out, and the coach that rolls the ball out will either run to the ball, simulating that's a city ball, and our guys will have to, you know, get down the ground to recover that, or just rolling the ball out there and the coach not moving to, again, simulate to them that that's a country ball and that's an opportunity for you to scoop and score. If you don't successfully get the scoop and score, now it turns into a city ball. So that's our ball period. Again, we spent 5 minutes on that. They do each one of those. You know, you're going to get one of those drills on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of every week.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because if you didn't, that was my question. Because there's, you know, when you see that happen, and I don't care what side of the ball you're on, if it's happening to your team where that guy did everything right to get the ball out and then everybody's falling all over themselves to get the football because, you know, that part hasn't, it's a skill. That skill has not been developed enough. And, you know, I really like how you described your drill, because it's not just, hey, I'm going to roll the ball out and tell you it's a city ball or a country ball. Like, I'm going to give you the visual that goes along with it, because football is a game of vision, decision, action, and that's what you're creating in that drill. So I love that. That's a great, great way to teach that. And appreciate you sharing all those details with us. One thing you brought up that I'm really interested in hearing about was your quarter half defense. It's something, you know, the past couple of years, you know, my son's been playing high school football, and you know, I have not actively been coaching, but I do. I'm the GA for the high school, right? I break down some film and give the coach a report, and then certainly watch on game days what's going on. And I see a lot of teams who try to play quarter half really leave themselves vulnerable to being attacked, especially on that boundary, that boundary hash, right? Somebody getting up that hash. And, you know, our team was able to take advantage of that with people. We had an opportunity in a playoff game, a team that wanted to play quarter half to take away, you know, one of our top receivers, but left themselves vulnerable in other places. And I know everything has its weaknesses, but how are you able to play that, you know, quite a bit of the time and be able to cover yourself up, be able to take away what appears to be, you know, an area that people should attack. But when they try to, you're able to shut it down.
So it all goes into, like I said, there's really three different ways that we will play our cover two over there. If you play it with a true cloud corner, half field pedal out of their safety, that is going to be an issue. That coverage is very good if you're getting more of maybe an out route, maybe your vertical routes, you know, just a true two-on-one on that receiver ability, you know, for the corner, get his hands on him and disrupt. The one thing that, you know, we do is to, you know, counteract that is our safety, rather than pedaling out, just tends to play more of a flat-footed technique. And he'll shuffle as part of his read steps and get his eyes to number one. And it'll honestly be a lot more of a man match zone. So that guy, if he runs that seven step, you know, bang post, he's going to be running into the corner, running into the safety, and it's going to immediately deter the offense from throwing that. A lot of times, again, they're not even going to throw it because if they're reading that guy and they see him, you know, flat footing it, it's going to tell them right now to hand the football off. The other way that we'll do, if we want to bring that guy, that safety down in the run support, obviously now you're telling the quarterback to throw that post. And we make a big emphasis on that corner. Again, rather than playing like a landmark cover two, he's playing a lot more of a man match zone. Anything really beyond 5 yards, yes, that guy's playing a half, but in our world, it's going to turn into man for them. And when he bails or when he backpedals, he's playing inside leverage on number one to take away, again, that glance route if they so choose to throw it. But that's how the glance would not hurt us. If you are backpedaling that safety out of there, it's going to hurt you. And that goes all back into the techniques that we play with those guys into the boundary, go into how we fit the run also. We keep our field linebacker, like I said, we call our spur out of the run fit a lot of times. And we'll play him outside leverage over there on number two. And because we play him outside leverage, his job is to send number two in. You know, a lot of people will reroute that number two inside out. We actually send him in to our field safety. And that field safety in is not just 1 yard inside of number two by his alignment. We have actually have him apexed between the center and number two, knowing that if two goes vertical, he can play him if the spur sends number two inside. Now with that, with how we teach, if two's bubbling to the field, which he's going to do a lot of times when you run that bang post, that safety to the front side of the field is now taking his eyes back to that quarterback, and I have him trained to eat that glance up. And we've gotten a couple interceptions this year on that backside safety to the field, taking away that glance route, intercepting it. They threw it maybe a hair late, just because they're never, ever accounting for that guy ever. And it starts with how you teach your run fits, where you're gaining your support, who's in conflict, who's not in conflict. And again, I think when you start to have all those different ways to manipulate the quarterback, a lot of times it deters them from trying to even run that stuff also.
I know, you know what we were able to have some success with it when I was at BW. It was out of our four vertical package. And, you know, I could think of one particular game where we had been hitting our single receiver on, you know, some go routes, some stutter routes. I mean, we were giving him some problems. He was eating up that corner. And so they started to, late in the game, play the quarter half. And, you know, I would like to switch release. And we had a couple versions where we could bring one and two in and have those guys take the hash landmarks and have number three get out to the number landmark, or just switch one and two. And we did exactly that. And gave the quarterback the alternate starting point where normally we're looking at, you know, one of those seams as our first look to start on the boundary with the singles. So he started on the boundary. The safety moved hard over the top to stop there. And now the field guy was, he was screwed. He was two on one because there wasn't a good reroute. And we hit the guy coming right across to the middle. And this was late in the game. Within 2 minutes, it was like an 86-yard touchdown to go ahead, end up winning the game. For something like that, I mean, that's definitely, for me, that was just, if I was seeing quarter, half, that's a strategy I'm going to right away. That's the first thing I'm going to try on you. So with those kinds of things, what's your answer to be able to stop something like that if you do want to play your quarter, half?
Yeah, so if you're just getting straight drop back pass, my first answer would be to have your hook defender to the cover two side to carry any vertical routes. By him carrying that vertical route, it's going to allow your safety to get some help and not be so stressed. The next answer would be is if you are, you know, if it's off a hard play action or off of RPOs, now we're going to have to keep that boundary linebacker out of the run fit. And now we're going to have to gain our run support from that field linebacker. As I talked about, we try not to do, but have the ability to do so if we need to. If you gain him in the run fit now and don't put any stress on that linebacker, that's going to allow your linebacker to always be able to carry, always be able to collision, reroute that number two receiver to help protect that corner over there. I'm sorry, to protect that safety over there as well. You also have other options as far as how you teach that corner in cover two. You know, is he going to be more of a read two guy where he's going to look to carry, you know, number one, or is he just going to be a hard, staunch, you know, collision and sink fade to flat? How you change the technique of that corner is also going to help defend those vertical concepts over there as well.
Coach, I'm kind of shifting gears here. You know, you brought up a couple things that you started to see, and we did a podcast all season long just on some trends we started to see and, you know, all the different games we were watching from the high school level all the way through the NFL. And definitely things have developed this season. I know I told you the biggest one I saw is everybody put mesh in their playbook, right? That was seems to be like the answer they wanted. If you were going to play some man or match and try to take away some of those RPOs, that was in everybody's playbook. I don't think it was, you know, talked to Hal Mummy, you know, last week, and he was quick to point out that it's not true mesh. They're not running it the right way. But the concept is there. The idea is we got a guy on the run, a lot of people trying to create some rubs along the way. I'm running away from the defender on him. But you saw a couple things in your conference and in your schedule really trended. And the first was in the run game. Our teams were doing an outside zone. They call it an outside zone G, pin and pull. Typically, you know, pin and pull was, you know, for me, is we were a power team and we got seven. We were going to go pin and pull to get you back to a nine so we could run power. But you saw it that a seven or nine team still running the pin and pull.
Yeah, really, if you're playing your seven technique, you knew that the pin and pull was going to get on the perimeter. If you moved your defensive end out and played more of a six or a nine, and then they blocked out on him, then a lot of times they were going to look to really just pin and pull up inside into that C-gap area. So it's still, regardless of what you gave them, they still wanted to get those pullers out and start to create confusion. And a lot of times there's a lot of RPOs off of that. We saw a lot of 2x2, 11 personnel, twins pro, pin and pull back to the tight end side, the slant of number two, or 3x1, tray open, pin and pull to the tight end with the slant by number one. A lot of that pin and pull with the outside zone RPO off of it. So, you know, that caused us, because they were so adamant about running it, we started to have to play, you know, all three different techniques to just kind of keep them on their toes, because I do like the ability to just kind of stay in a seven technique and make that tight end block you and, you know, not allow that tight end on any type of arc releases at times to block your safety and, you know, your defensive end and widen him. So I had to play some different games there with that.
And then, Coach, you mentioned the other thing that you were seeing was the empty RPO screens on the outside and reading one of your linebackers. It was something. Well, you know, Kyle Orodzanski, who's your quarterback's coach on your staff, when he played for us at BW, we had that empty play. I remember it. He ran it against Muskingum. It was a read away from Mike, and everybody got into their pass drops, and he was up the middle for a touchdown. So it's definitely an effective scheme. What kinds of things were you seeing? What was your answers, I guess, to defend something like that? Most teams, I guess, I'll preface that, Coach. The most teams, you're able to catch them in their empty check. And, you know, I don't know that having one empty check, I don't know what your philosophy is. I'm not sure that that is the way to operate nowadays when teams are looking to do all kinds of things, especially with RPO, and can figure out real quick if they can hurt your empty check.
Right. It's a play I like. If I was ever an offensive coordinator, I do like that play because it definitely limits you from a defensive standpoint. And I think, honestly, I think regardless of what the defense does, the advantage is really to the offense there, whether you choose to blitz it, whatever it may be. But what we chose to do was, yes, you're correct. You have to have multiple empty checks these days. Our empty game plan varies week to week. If we see on film that, you know, they haven't shown much empty, we're going to have, hey, we're empty check this week is this call. But if we do see, you know, maybe 20 snaps of empty on film and the breakdowns, then we're going to have play it calls. And, you know, we're going to have anywhere from 3 to 6 different ways to play different coverages in empty. But yeah, that play, I mean, they'd spread you out and they're going to choose which linebacker to read. And for us, we kind of had a pretty good beat on it and how they were reading it and who they were going to read. And it was for us, it was imagining, okay, who do we want carrying the football? Do we want them spitting it out and running the bubble, or do we want the quarterback to run the football? And, you know, it just so happened that that particular week we're like, I want the quarterback to run the football because I know they don't have a backup quarterback and I'd rather take our chances, the defensive line canceling out gaps and our linebackers clearing their cleats and tackling the quarterback than us having to, you know, play the games out on the perimeter and potentially get cut, not fit something right with our corner, whatever it may be. So we really looked at who do we want to have the football in their hands. And again, we were able to study enough to figure out how we could dictate what they did. And so that's been very lucky to have a very good coaching staff here at Finley that understands offensive football. And, you know, once you know, understand how they're going to attack you and you know what their roles are, then kind of think the cards can kind of come back into our hands as a defense. How can we get them to do what we want them to do? And those are things that we talk about on a routine basis in our staff meetings.
Coach, and you've talked about that as, you know, really, I think a key thing in how you defend the RPO is first deciding who we want to have the ball. You know, for our listeners, could you, and it could be a very basic example, but could you talk us through exactly how you would game plan something up to make sure that, you know, that one, and you could pick them, is it the receiver, is it the running back, is it the quarterback, to have that one guy be keeping the ball, and that's the guy you want to defend. Can you walk us through maybe just a basic example of how you look at that and how you create that?
Absolutely. So let's just take the number one formation we saw this year was 2-by-1 formation, twins of the field, X receiver of the boundary, and then you got your H-back. All right, that's we call it 11 personnel still, even though he's an H-back, but that's the number one formation that we see every year. So let's just take your standard inside zone, all right, with the boundary glance as the RPO off of that. All right. Again, I'm confident that because we keep that field linebacker out of the run fit, that we are guaranteed to have true 3-over-2 to the field and no one is in conflict. So offenses aren't going to look to attack us over there. All right. It's not winning football from a number standpoint for them. So they're going to have to run their RPO to the boundary. All right. So I know that more often than not, your standard inside zone RPO, you know, they can do whatever with the H. They can have the H insert into the B gap, you know, and run more of an ISO look off of it. They can have the H, you know, flash across and kick out the end, whatever style of inside zone you want. That I'm not concerned with that. But if we choose to gain our, let's say we want the quarterback to hand the football off, then we will gain our boundary run support. We will run a boundary stunt, give our boundary corner the C gap. He is our seventh hat in the run game. And now when the quarterback is reading our safety, they're going to see the safety saying hi, they're going to hand the football off. And now you have the quarterback handing the football off into seven hats, and that is enough in your H-back run game to defend any type of inside zone. If I want them to throw the RPO, then we'll make a call. And again, our safety is the one manipulating all of these calls, where he is going to be the guy that comes down in the run support and be our seventh hat. And when he runs down, we now know that they're going to look to throw the football. So just something as simple as that. And in our world, you know, our seven hats in the run game, I talk about our 4D linemen, our two inside backers, and whether we choose to gain that corner or that safety as the seventh hat. If you're just running inside zone and zone read with the quarterback, our seven hats are enough to defend that. Where the offense can gain the advantage is if you're running gap scheme run game with your quarterback, now we're going to look at having to do something to gain maybe an eighth hat in the run game. If you're running, you know, true quarterback power or quarterback ISOs, those run games and run concepts now create different issues where we're going to have to change a little bit about what we do. But if you're just talking about inside zone, quarterback's reading a guy, well, he's going to either hand it off or throw it. That's how we look to manipulate who has the football in their hands.
For you, when you do have to get that eighth guy in, what do you see as just a simple way? So if, a high school coach is out there looking at this and thinking about that same type of thing, you know, obviously limited time, sometimes because guys are playing two ways or whatever it might be. So you got to be simple in how you do it. What would you like to do to get that extra guy into the run fit?
Probably the most well-rounded way would be to just play quarters, straight quarters, Michigan State style quarters, where both of those overhangs are heavy in the run game. Now you're back to having enough hats to defend that, but in theory, you're playing cover zero back there. Another way that we may look to counteract that is we may just run a whole bunch of line stunts and still look to keep those same seven hats in the run game, but hopefully we can run some different line movements that are going to allow one guy to, in theory, defend two gaps to help put the numbers back in an even playing field for us. The third way, I think, is if you want to play more of a one-high style look, is how you teach that middle of the field safety. If you're teaching him to backpedal at the snap, you're going to have issues. But if you kind of have him flat-footed and read the mesh point of the quarterback, now that's another way to look to gain run support. So those are just three ways right there that, you know, can all be looked at. And I do think quarters is probably the most expensive if you don't do it. The other ways, you know, are tiny tweaks that they may not be as good because there's issues with those, but it's, in my opinion, a quick fix or a nice little change up to do so.
Well, Coach, I certainly appreciate the time you spent with us today. I know for you it's a busy time with recruiting. Much appreciated that you would take some time and talk some ball with us here. And, you know, for our listeners out there, guys over at Finley are doing a great job with their program on both sides of the ball. There's some really good coaches I've been able to meet, obviously been able to coach one of those guys. So I highly encourage you to check out what they're doing. Coach, how can they get in contact with you? What's the best way to just learn more about what you're doing or maybe ask you a few questions?
Yeah, obviously on Twitter, @ Coach Macrinos is my handle. My email is on the Finley website. And they can give me a call. I have my phone number is 419-889-7925. Call me and I'll do whatever I can to help anyone.
Well, Coach, thanks again. I appreciate the kind words at the beginning and being a loyal listener, and you're welcome back here anytime to talk some ball.
Thanks. I appreciate your time, this opportunity, and getting the chance to know you and talk some more football with you. It's been awesome as well, Keith.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.